Catholic Family Podcast presents Lent Around the World, daily traditional Catholic meditations read by our friends from across the globe.
The Passion and Death of Our Lord Jesus Christ by the Most Reverend Alban Goodyear. Part 35. The Fifth Word, I Thirst. The Roman guard knew no Hebrew, unless it were a word and a phrase which every soldier learns when serving in a foreign land. Still less did they know the language or meaning of prayer. Naturally, then, when they heard their dying victim call on his father by the name Eloi, they understood nothing of what he said. They knew something of the myths and fables of these despised Jews about them, and had learnt to laugh at their credulity. There was a fable of a prophet, Elias. The sound they caught from the lips of Jesus brought this story to their minds. Elias, these Jews said, had been taken to heaven in a chariot of fire, and perhaps this man, who called himself a prophet, was praying that the same might now be done to him. Perhaps he was asking that Elias might come as he had gone and take him out of his misery. And some of them that stood there and heard said, "Behold, this man calleth for Elias." Meanwhile, Jesus continued his prayer. Life seemed now to have no further meaning for him. This earth had become indeed to him the valley of this death, and he longed now for the moment when he might leave it. But there was another prophecy yet to be fulfilled, one more sign which later his followers might add to the rest, when at last they would see and believe. It had been written by the psalmist, "Thou knowest my reproach, and my confusion, and my shame. In thy sight are all they that afflict me. My heart hath expected reproach and misery. And I looked for one that would grieve together with me, and there was none. And for one that would comfort me, and I found none. And they gave me gall for my food, and in my thirst they gave me vinegar to drink." That last prophecy must now be accomplished, and all would be done. He would suggest its accomplishment. By so doing, he would remind men for all time of a further agony he endured, perhaps the greatest that man can endure: death from sheer thirst. He had known thirst before. Indeed, he had been careful to let it be seen throughout his life how he suffered from the needs of the body. Almost the first thing we heard of him was that he was hungry, so craving for food, that Satan himself thought to take advantage of his weakness. He was weary at a well on the roadside, more weary than the companions who were with him. He had sat down at that well and had asked a stranger woman to give him to drink, the only time recorded in the gospel story where he had asked anyone for anything. In Capernaum at times the crowds had so thronged upon him that he had been unable to take his meals. He had slept, weary, on a boat, and a storm had not awakened him. If Jesus could say of himself that he had not whereon to lay his head, perhaps, too, he could also have said that they had not where to get food and drink. For these he depended on what men gave him. For some, he would turn water into wine. For others, he would multiply bread so that all might eat. For himself, he was content to sit by a well and say to a passerby, "Give me to drink." Nor is it without significance that he had often used the relieving of thirst as an illustration in teaching. Men speak of what they know and experience. Jesus then knew thirst in his missionary tours. He knew the agony with which he would die. Hence, when he spoke of the torture of a soul condemned, it is this torture of thirst on which he dwells. "Father Abraham, have mercy on me, and send Lazarus, that he may dip the tip of his finger in water to cool my tongue, for I am tortured in this flame." When he spoke of charity to others, it was under the figure of a cup of water given in his name. He promised heaven to those who gave him to drink. In the height of his preaching in the temple, the climax seems to be reached when he cries, "If any man thirst, let him come to me and drink." Of all his sufferings, this was the only one of which Jesus spoke during the whole of his passion. In a true sense, it was the greatest of them all. Yet, was it also one which might easily have passed unnoticed? Travelers tell us of the horrors of thirst, the one torture which drives a man mad. Often on a sickbed, especially when there has been a great loss of blood, we may see the almost insatiable craving to drink. And in the East, in places barren and salt, under a broiling sun, we may taste something of the agony of thirst, which will readily bring home to us why Jesus chose the cup of water as his emblem of charity, why he chose the quenching of thirst as the character of his own deep love. Of this, then, he would remind his own at this moment. The loss of blood, the long fast, the all but bursting heart, had indeed produced in him a thirst almost intolerable. Moreover, the scriptures must be fulfilled, and there were yet more things to be done. We recognize the intended deliberation in the evangelist's narrative as if he would say, this was no complaint, rather was it a command. Afterwards, Jesus, knowing that all things were accomplished, said, I thirst. These at least were words which the soldiers and those about him understood. But what could his friends do to relieve him? The women who in Galilee had followed him and had ministered to his wants stood there now, empty-handed. Mary Magdalene, at whose house he had supped in Bethania, would gladly now have left the bleeding feet to which she clung and served him, but she had nothing now to give. Mary, his mother, at whose prayer, for others' sake, he had once turned water into wine, was helpless now. Only the soldiers might do something. They had with them their own coarse wine, to the Jewish taste more vinegar than wine, with which they regaled themselves during the long hours of watching. There was a sponge lying on the ground. Crucifying criminals was soiling work, and executioners needed at times to wash their hands and perhaps their faces. A soldier picked up the sponge and put it in the jar of wine. He took also a stick, a hyssop stalk of a foot long, not more, and fixed the soaked sponge upon it. He held it up to the blood-stained lips of Jesus, not 2 feet above him. Jesus sipped a little of the liquor from the sponge. Before, when he was offered drink to stupefy him, he had refused it, but this he did not refuse. By accepting it, he would reward this last act of charity, even though it came from an executioner. Though others about him might still murmur in contempt, stay, let us see whether Elias will come and take him down from the cross, Jesus would pay honor to the man who helped him in his hour of distress. For to have been the last man on earth to serve the dying Lord, was not this honor indeed? For whosoever shall give you to drink a cup of water in my name, amen, I say to you, he shall not lose his reward. Part 36, the 6th and 7th words. All was now completed. The prophecies, one by one, had been fulfilled. The will of his Father had been done to the last iota. Did you not know that I must be about my Father's business? Had been the first words with which he had begun his career. Often he had reminded those about him, friends and enemies alike, that to carry out the will of his Father was the beginning and was to be the end of his whole life. It mattered not whether what he did was to succeed or not. He could look back now from his cross on Calvary and realize how, in the eyes of men, his life had been one long failure. Nazareth, where he had been brought up, was scandalized because of him and twice cast him out. Capernaum, his own city, walked with him no more. Chorazin and Bethsaida, where he had done most of his miracles, had, in the end, to be condemned. Galilee was made unsafe for him, and he had gone out from it into exile. Jerusalem had never received him, and from the very beginning there had always been those in the city who sought his life. He was the outcast of men. He was the scandal of his own. He who would have championed the cause of Jesus Christ at that moment would have been hard put to it to find an argument in his defense. Nevertheless, his work had been done, and he could look on it all with content. His father had willed that he should be the satisfaction for the race of fallen men, and he had poured out his blood for them all. Not one drop only, which would have sufficed, but would never have satisfied his love. His work on earth was over. He had run his course. He had now been baptized with that baptism for which he had longed. Already at the supper, he had prayed, "Father, the hour is come. Glorify thy Son, that thy Son may glorify thee. I have glorified thee on the earth. I have finished the work thou gavest me to do. And now glorify thou me, O Father, with thyself, with the glory which I had before the world was with thee." After that prayer, there had still remained the chalice to be drunk. And now he had drunk it to the dregs. He had said all and could say no more. He had done all and could do no more. He had given his all, and there was no more to give. He could now lay down his life, the final and supreme act of love. For, as he had proclaimed on many occasions, that too should be a deliberate act of his own. He who had commanded life and death for others could command them for himself. He could lay down his life and could take it up again. And this should be made manifest to those who witnessed his last moments. He would not come down from the cross at their bidding. Instead, by the way he died, he would prove to those who were open to conviction that he was more than man. He looked back on the past. It was now the fullness of time. The history of the ages converged on that moment. He looked into the future. From the foot of that cross, the new world would begin. During the last hours, he had successively passed sentence on Annas and Caiaphas and Pilate, on enemies, on friends, and on all the world. Now he would pass sentence on himself. With the voice of no dying man, but with the loud voice of a conqueror, he would pronounce his own claim, his own right to reward. In spite of the utter desolation through which he was passing, he could trust himself to his Father. When Jesus therefore had taken the vinegar, he said, "It is consummated." And Jesus, again crying with a loud voice, said, "Into thy hands I commend my spirit." And saying this, bowing down his head, he gave up the ghost. The most tremendous deed that has ever been done upon this earth was completed. The most tremendous crime turned into the most tremendous act of love, love alike of God and of men. Jesus Christ, the Son of God made man, was dead, and the earth bore his dead body through the infinite spaces. Nature, that had long waited for the revelation of the sons of God, nature that had groaned and travailed in pain even till now, when all was over, was itself shaken. And behold, the sun was darkened, and the veil of the temple was rent in two in the midst, from the top even to the bottom. And the earth quaked, and the rocks were rent, and the graves opened. And many bodies of the saints that had slept arose, and coming out of the tombs after his resurrection, came into the holy city and appeared to many.